it's not many people that you grow up with since four that you still stay in contact with through your latter years, and on top of it, create something with that person and make something with that person. And on top of that, make something that people seem to dig.
Q-Tip, the abstract. He's not going to say it about himself outside of the playful banter of a rhyme, so I'll say it. He's one of the most recognizable voices and influential minds in the history of hip-hop music. Q-Tip is probably best known as part of A Tribe Called Quest, a group that emerged in the late 80s and early 90s. Hits like Can I Kick It, Scenario, and Bonita Applebum cemented Tribe's place as innovators, both in their lyrical cadence and the way they use sampling and a broad mix of musical genres to make something new. I'm John Ford from CNBC, and you're listening to the Fort Knox podcast, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. I do this weekly, bringing you the highest achievers. We're going to learn how the very best climb to the top and pull out lessons along the way. If that sounds good to you, make this a habit and subscribe. A Tribe Called Quest released its final album in November of 2016. Member Fife Dog, Malik Taylor, passed away from diabetes complications earlier that year. I talked to Tip about his new music, his other creative efforts, Morning Fife, and the state of the music business. Here's Q-Tip.
Prince would have been 60 years old today.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were both coming up in New York throughout the 80s.
Yeah.
And for me, as a young kid, 1984, Purple Rain was one of those moments, unique because it was bringing together this album and this look that Prince had and this movie all at the same time. It was such a creative convergence. I wonder, what did Prince mean to you as a developing creative person who hadn't really launched your career
yet? Oh, major, one of my major influences. You know, I have a few, and he's definitely in there.
What is it about?
Definitely, like, since his first album, he's just... I feel like, especially in today's world, the word genius gets used carelessly, but it's appropriate in his case. You know, you're talking about a prodigy who at 18 recorded his whole album and self-produced it, which was kind of unheard of for like 1978-79. And he's somebody that I've always like admired, studied, delved it. Like, he's just so much a part of what I do even still to this day. So, and then, you know, as I've, you know, went into my career, having the opportunity to have worked with him and knew him like intimately, like that was my boy. Like, he was like my big brother, and we would have just hours and hours and hours of conversation about music, life, everything that you could imagine. And then to be able to be share the stage with him and to work in the studio with him is just like... You see, I'm pinching myself. I still... You know what I mean?
I hear you tell people clearly, to study music. Like, not just... Don't just play it, but go deep and understand why different types of rhythm and different chords and scales work.
We didn't really have that, because I'm not trying to, like, to my horn or his or whatever, but we kind of connected like that creatively and musically. So we passed that initial, I guess, barrier of musical language and all of that stuff. And we became friends, you know what I'm saying? That was my big brother. Like, he would like tell me other stuff. And, you know, he was like one of the first guys like on the internet. And I remember him like telling me all about it and setting up his sites and stuff like that and just watching it. And, you know, it was just really a great, you know, he's one of my mentors, you know, and I miss him dearly. It's, you know, it's still doesn't, you know, that whole year, 2016, of the loss, you know, because right prior to that, I lost Fife. And I think he reached out, but I didn't get to speak to him because I was just in the middle of all the bereavement and all of that stuff. But then a few weeks later, he was gone. It was just like, wow, you know, it was just a heavy blow. But his contribution is timeless, you know, when the archaeologists come to go through the rubble and they look for, you know, what was this culture, they're going to look to the art first, and I'm sure they'll find, you know, his follicle.
Yeah, yeah. You understand this better than I do, mm-hmm. but he had a kind of ambivalent relationship with things like streaming services mm-hmm. and his actual music on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go through that?
Well,
do
you know, still go through that? It gets crazy, you know, because there's energy and forces out here that that tend to, when you have when you get blessed with an idea, right? Mm-hmm. And you get blessed with the fortitude and the moxie to be able to kind of go through it and see it out, and you do it more than one time, especially in a creative sense. And then you start to see that, like, whether it be, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, music. It could be, you know, in tech. It could be in politics. It could be whatever it is your acumen. If you get this thing that's kind of really unique and you start to step into truth and step into light, you know, the obvious thing is the thing that's anti it, right?
Mm.
And then, you know, we exist in a paradigm here where, well, it's capitalism. We have to capitalize.
Right.
So then when we enter into these contracts, into these deals, you know, everybody is, I think, trying to look out for their best interests, but it seems that the controlling factor goes beyond looking for their best interests. It starts to become
control even more.
Control.
Yeah. Which for a creative person.
Yeah, right? You see that, right?
It sucks all the oxygen.
Yeah.
Out.
And if you don't have faith, and I'm not just talking about a faith in your talent or a faith in what, you know, you were gifted, but a faith in where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be rough because you're always going to be dealing with challenges.
And a faith, are you saying because...
So
especially
his
young artists might
about,
think
yeah,
that they need the label, that they
well,
need those power structures.
Well, yeah, well, and the ambivalence about that that he had for, you know, streaming services and putting things online and stuff like that. It's manyfold. And I think because this is kind of the fashion and the parlance of the day where we stream now, you don't go out and buy a collection of songs, speaking specifically to music,
mm-hmm.
it's been chopped up. I think that the music industry, you know, has missed a step or two, but one of the major steps that I think that they missed in the latter part of the last century, which they're still kind of like licking their wounds from, is not embracing the internet and how the internet can, you know, be another conduit for them to put out product. They kind of, where the music industry was still a little bit fat off of the CD explosion, because it's all about how many different ways can we present this in a hardware. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, it was a cassette. Oh, okay, so I'm not gonna go too far back, but you know, it's vinyl.
Uh-huh.
Then when they figured out they could put the same thing out with no cost, but just on a different medium, which is cassette, they reintroduce that. They have these talks with, you know, different, you know, audio companies and car companies on how they can change their formats that now can assist this. It gets a wider reach, which is great for the audience and great for the artist because now it's dispersed on another medium. Now here comes the CD. And when everything was reissued on CD in the 90s, or the 80s rather, the music business saw a crazy surge because their catalog just got bought again, like by all of the consumers. So then when the internet came along, you know, I think a lot of the gatekeepers were like, eh, get away from here, kid. Or Sean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was something that they didn't see, they didn't have the vision to see that far ahead. It was kind of like a new thing for, you know, a lot of us on that end, you know, in the business. So they didn't really have people in there that could see the explosion. So now the music business has to kind of reapproach their contracts, reapproach how they deal with artists. They cut off different arms of their companies, like artist development arms and things of that nature, to save costs. And now it's really about you know, analytics and numbers and metrics to try to like gauge what's what, so that they can jump in. Am I making sense?
No, that makes sense. I was just with Troy Carter about a week ago.
Yeah,
he's working with Spotify. Yeah.
Troy's great.
I guess trying to build that artist development sense up for the new era, and so much of it seems to be missing in the industry. And I wonder, I mean, have you kind of made some degree of your peace with that? Because when I listen to Abstract Radio, right, on Apple Music, it's a huge canvas at the same time. It used to be there were more gatekeepers in between you getting your ideas as a producer, as an artist, out to the masses.
Right.
Like I remember reading an interview with Jay Dilla, who's a protege of yours, about you know, waiting for the label to release his stuff.
Right.
And maybe it was too edgy for him. Now in this day and age, you can break stuff on Abstract Radio. You don't have those same radio gatekeepers that you used to have.
Right.
Or if you're a super creative producer out in Detroit, you can put your stuff out there and get discovered and build your own audience. Is that, so, on balance, good?
That's good. It's actually the thing, which is why we all have this debate and these talks about it, because it's, you know, you see how it works, and then you see, you know, how it doesn't. But that's with anything, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the great thing for artists, just pro artists, about, you know, putting your music out is, like you said, you don't have to wait around. You could get it going on your own, you know, and, you know, it's really liberating to do that. But then the other problem on the other side of that is that because of that availability and because of that instant access to be able to professionally gather your ideas and launch it out yourself, is that because of the ease, you know, now a lot of people feel like that they can do it too, kinda. And that's a problem, because for the actual work, you know, like, I didn't just wake up and just, you know, I had to still work. It's work. You have to put the time in. You have to put the hours in. You have to put the days in. And you can't cut corners, because if you do, you know, all of that easy access to be able to make stuff and push a button and put it out, and you may catch a lick initially, but because of the lack of work and substance that's there, it's going to be short-lived.
Yeah.
So I would encourage everybody that, because, yes, there is an ease and a quicker track to getting your thoughts and ideas out there, you still can't duck the responsibility that you need to have to your craft, you know.
Yeah, some stuff.
Yeah.
some old stuff you go back to and it sounds old
today, yeah,
and some stuff you go back to and it still sounds fresh.
Yeah. And then just, you know, you have this whole conversation today about like, oh, music is this, is that. It's, you know, I tend to see a lot of great things, but I also see some things of, like I said, where, you know, some people don't want to put that time and that work in. You know what I'm saying? They just want to get to that end result, you know. So I see that. And, you know, it's just an interesting equation.
I want to talk the making of Tip a little bit.
Okay.
I'm about to go to my 20th college reunion tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Right.
I went to school in rural Indiana, Greencastle, Indiana. I'm a kid from New York, Washington, D.C. But
how'd
you
wind up there?
Well, they had a good media program, and I was into, like, diversity and understanding different points of view. So I said, why shouldn't I go to school in the rural Midwest?
Right.
I never spent any time there. Let me go out there and see what it's about.
Okay.
It was rough for a while, and I found, I ended up writing about 50 songs throughout college. And for me, the music was like alchemy. It's like you can turn pain into something beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my way of working through a lot of things, because it could be the lyrics, the tune, whatever came out of pain. And then when I played it, I could sort of work it out.
Right.
You've talked about how in ninth grade,
right,
you dealt with the passing of your father
and
got into music at the same time.
Yeah.
Is that part of how you work through some of the things that life throws at you?
It's cathartic. It's definitely a refuge. And that's one of the things that unify all of us underneath the auspices of art, right?
Mm.
Whether it be music or literature or film or what have you, you know, these things, you know, are able to potentially encapsulate where you are in your life, good, bad, or otherwise. These things are able to encapsulate how you feel about yourself or about the world or about others in a specific way. And these things are able to encapsulate your queries or your pains or your questions or your sadness. And then also able to, like, help build you and make you and inspire you to go forward. So for me, you know, watching my father basically pass for over a year in front of me and then in passing when I was 16, you know, the music was just always a safe haven for me, you know. It was a place where I got to express myself, you know.
Yeah.
And all of that. So it was definitely a refuge.
Is touring cathartic or was it hard? I remember seeing you and Jarobi on stage after this last album.
Right.
And I remember, I think it was SNL, when the banner came down with Fife on it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it looked like it was hard to have his voice booming, but him not there.
Yeah.
And then for you to have to go through multiple nights of that.
It was very trying.
Yeah.
But it was also cathartic too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we were still working it out, you know? I'm sure some of the people who were watching or listening were still kind of working out that loss for them, but just loss in general. Mm. But for me, personally, it was something. And then, you know, after that, we did a few shows, but I couldn't move without him there. You know, it was definitely a lot. But I'm happy that I accepted that challenge and went through it and experienced that. And I'm able to call it out and notate what I was feeling, you know?
Yeah.
I think that was instrumental for my continued growth.
Mm.
But yeah, it was tough. Yeah. When you hear the voice and you're on stage and it's something that not only did we build it, but I knew him since we were 4 years old, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So to lose your friend, it's not many people that you grow up with since four that you still stay in contact with through your latter years, and on top of it, create something with that person and make something with that person. And on top of that, make something that people seem to dig, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like,
all of those things, you know, sit there.
It's hard to capture for people who didn't live through it, but the Native Tongues was like the Avengers of hip-hop. It was a collective including such artists and acts as the Jungle Brothers, De La Soul, Leaders of the New School, Black Sheep, Queen Latifah, Moni Love, and of course, A Tribe Called Quest. Queen Latifah and Moni Love had some tracks that would be revolutionary today in the way they challenged sexism and the culture. Black Sheep pushed back against the rise of gangster culture. It wasn't all uplifting, straight-edge message music, but it was a different take from the mainstream.
There's a certain demographic, probably between age 35 and 50. I fall in there.
Mm.
Where, I mean, yeah, we listen to a lot of music, but Tribe, the Native Tongues movement, I'm sure you hear it all the time, how, man, that meant something to me, you know, personally. It was like almost a representation thing, even within Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
There was an acknowledgement that we were more than one-dimensional.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
Queen Latifah and Moni Love brought that,
yes.
You know,
yes.
With UNITY.
Yes.
Those lyrics and those issues, yes. Just yeah. As relevant today as they were back then. What do you think it was about the Native Tongues, what you guys were about, that meant so much to a generation?
I think that at the time, you know, we were just blessed to be able to be at the right time at the right place. That's part of it. But also, you know, prior, I guess, to us, you were starting to see different shades of Black complexity through this music.
Mm-hmm.
On this initial, you know, implosion from the, you know, early 70s up into like the 80s, it was kind of like a, you know, a smaller dimension. But like most things that, you know, that grow, it started to widen. And then through that, it was able to carve out paths for other people to enter us. And then, you know, at that time we were able to express that we're more than one dimension, that we don't just do X. We do A and D and H and J and, you know,
and
just like everybody else. Just like
right.
Everybody else.
Yeah.
So because we were kind of like the first to kind of like, you know, have that kind of position about, you know, showing our complexity and showing our levels and showing our depth. I think that that's probably why there's still, you see J. Cole and you see Kendrick, and there's still, it's outgrowths of that, it's outspurts of that, you know.
And Kanye.
Yeah, and Kanye.
Also somebody who
Kanye
looks up to you.
Yeah, a guy called Wes.
Right? That's right. He took that from A Tribe Called Quest and flipped it,
yeah.
Kind of like you're doing with Elton, paying tribute to you. The biggest cultural moment from my childhood that I remember with hip hop was EPMD.
Oh,
Roxanne.
Right.
No, UTFO. Sorry.
Okay.
I get the four letters.
Okay,
UTFO.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you had Roxanne.
You said EPMD. I'm like, oh, no, you going there?
Yeah, EPMD too. But the cultural moment was UTFO, Roxanne. Because I remember that would come on the radio 1 week, And then you had like a response.
Answer. Yeah.
You had Roxanne Shanté. Yeah. You know, you had this feminist response to it. You had Roxanne's grandmother. You had, it was like every week right. there was another right. twist on
right.
this
right.
showing the diversity of viewpoints and kind of like this conversation yeah. emerging the on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have that anymore? Should we? Do we still have the diversity of voices in any musical genre that are doing that kind of almost jazz-like call and response and riff on each other?
You do, but going back to the whole record company paradigm, it's probably harder for you to find. You have to really seek it out. You almost have to go down a labyrinth on YouTube or something if you put up, you know, Roxanne on YouTube and then Roxanne's Revenge and Roxanne Shanté and Roxanne, you know, when you look to the videos on the right, you see, you know, other suggested use of things that are similar. And then it takes you down a path and then maybe you'll find somebody in 2018 who's from Piscataway or whatever that's, you know, looking at things from different perspectives. There's people who are kind of having those kind of conversations musically. But, you know, record companies aren't going to pay attention to that unless for it's already starting to grow and there's already an audience and there's already, like, all these gazillion followers because they don't have time to get into the development stages to help bring those things out and really shine a huge light on them.
Mm.
So they'll wait and see if that conversation of the cat from Piscataway grows over a period of time. And once they do, then they'll jump in and then we'll see it. So to answer your question, is that still happening? Yes, but I feel like it's cloaked.
Right.
You really have to kind of find it.
You've embraced this role, it seems to me, as a sort of historian, archaeologist, philosopher in hip-hop and beyond. You're getting ready to teach this course at NYU on the link between jazz and hip-hop.
Right.
You're also an artistic director, creative director. Forgive me for mangling the title at Kennedy Center.
I mangle it all the time, by the way. I'm like, what is it?
And you pulled together, you're not trying to do it by yourself, you pulled together a bunch of thinkers.
Right.
Questlove, Black Thought, you know, from the roots. Journalists who have been following hip-hop for just lots of people. Tell me about this. I think once I heard you talk about different periods for artists. This period for Tip, what is this period of professorial?
I have no idea. I'm in the middle of it, bro. So I'm just following it. Like, you know, I mean, and it's kind of a natural thing, you know, I guess when you get into elder statesmanship, you know, you start
to... So you've embraced that, huh?
Do I embrace it? Yeah.
You're at elder statesman now? Is that...
I guess. Am I? I don't know.
In our 40s? Or that,
I mean, when you start teaching, I don't know. You know, these terms are... I'm trying to say these things to help everybody understand, I guess. But I don't really put too much weight on the... titles.
I just can't believe we're that old.
You know what I'm saying?
Now,
you know, I don't feel
people
like
talk
it,
about,
and I don't feel like our, we're yeah, old.
I don't think so.
I feel like we're life. We're living. You know what I mean? It's all, every moment is an opportunity for you to gain wisdom.
You're one of those iceberg guys where 90% of the songs and beats that you created are still below the surface. We haven't seen it.
Yeah, I do. Which is probably why Prince is my boy, right?
That's
because
right. Yeah.
He has like I have a lot of stuff, but I'm striving to like put it all out, you know. But there's other things that happen in life that you have to kind of tend to as well and take care of and set up. But I'm confident that all of that stuff will see a light of day, and I could continue to do that. But
tell me about Abstract Radio as part of it.
Yeah,
because I mean, it's like 2 hours long. That's long.
It's long.
And it's rich and layered. That's got to take a lot of time.
But, well, time, right?
Yeah.
And you can't get time back. So I try to make try to make it enjoyable and, again, palatable for everybody who could potentially be checking it out, you know.
What does it do for you?
It makes me happy. I feel connected, energized, peace with it. You know, I have fun.
Mm-hmm.
It informs.
How so?
Because I get to, through mixing, you know, I put myself where I have to listen to a whole bunch of new things, you know. And I really try to source out certain things and make certain musical connections between something that could be present day that maybe people haven't looked at and something that could have been yesterday.
It sounds like you do work that forces you to do a process.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Like the work makes you do the work. Deepens you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's important for a creative person. Maybe that's a lesson. No matter what you're doing, take that away. Do work that makes you work.
That makes you work. That makes you not think about the fact that you're doing work. You understand what I'm saying? Do work that makes you not think about the fact that you're doing work.
Hmm.
Before we set off to do our work, you know, we could be anxious or doubt or, you know, nervous or whatever. But the minute we drop into and we step, because we have to do it, so when we drop into it and you get into it, it's almost like when you start running, for all of you runners out there, like after you hit a certain pace, you know, your endorphins kick in and it gets bright and you could go a little bit further. You don't think about the fact at a point that you're running because you're working and it starts to feel good. It builds you. So when you do work that makes you not think that it's work and you drop in, you start to do it, it feeds you, it builds you. The work, it becomes, it's rote. Mm. It's a meditation. And then by the time it's done, it's like, wow, I did that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then you realize, then when you start having to do the dailies of life and you do whatever you do and you have to get up the next day, it still could be daunting. Oh, man, I got to do this, I got to do that. But the minute you drop in and you commit to it and do it, It's a joy. It's a blessing. It's a gift.
Yeah.
I love it.
You going to do more TV?
I'd like to.
I know you're talking about that Native Tongues thing with DiCaprio for a while.
Yeah. We were talking about doing that. And, you know, he and I, we have some things that we're working on developing right now for film and TV. We've been working on some things for a while. And would love to do that. Would love to do some acting again if we get the opportunity to.
Ah, Miles Davis.
The Miles Davis thing, yeah. Yeah, so that's...
What did you get from that?
A connection to another one of my heroes. You know, it's funny because I wrote it as a short at the time. Christine Vachon was heading a company called Killer Films.
And give people the name of it so that I'm not just throwing out Miles Davis.
It's called My Funny Valentine. But we're currently we're out there. We're talking to some folks out there. We haven't closed yet, but we're in the middle of talks. But it started with Christine Vachon at Killer Films, so I have to give a shout out to because. She was going to let me, it was going to be a short, and I was going to be in it and direct it. And I just left a meeting with her. And I was going to meet up with Nelson George, who's a writer, journalist, director.
Yeah.
Fantastic guy. So I had the script under my arm. I was going to meet him because he was going to write a bio. And I guess I put it down, and he saw, like, a script with Miles Davis. He said, what's this? And I said, I wrote this I just left Killer Films. I'm going to do a short and da-da-da-da. He was like, oh, man, give it to me. Let me write it. We need to do a whole thing. And he took it and he wrote it. And, you know, we're here with it. And I just got I gained the connection to Miles. I gained the connection to my artist, to that world, and told a story. I was able to, like, not be myself and portray this other thing. It's another side that I don't get to do much, but I enjoy. Mm. You know?
You get to see a lot of different facets mm-hmm. of the creative process, the entertainment industry, just from the people you've met and gathered around you over the years. I heard somebody say once that music makes money for everything except music. You put music sells everything but music. You put it in a commercial and it sells the cars.
Right, okay.
You know, you put mm-hmm. it in a TV show, it sells the scene, you know, movie soundtracks, you get all emotional when you hear the music. But these days anyway, in mm-hmm. this period, music has a hard time creating a business yeah. model around itself. Right. Is it live shows where artists these days need to look to actually eat, you know, to figure out how to...
I mean, initially, yeah, you know, the road is one way, but, you know, record companies for a minute were doing, and probably still do these things called 360 deals where they now are trying to take your road money and your merch money, mm. you know, so they're trying to, and again...
Would you say don't do those?
I would say don't do those, yeah. but... you know, they've made a compelling case for themselves because some of the things that they offer, I guess, it depends if you're in it for fame and popularity and all that stuff or whatever. But again, and I hate to sound like I'm not trying to like berate the music industry and smack them in the back of the hand, but truth is truth, you know what I'm saying? And
was it music industry rule you know, number 4,080?
Like, hey, and you know, the thing is that because they're still licking their wounds from their, you know, being remiss of not to be inclusive on the initial phase of the internet, and they're trying to like monetize everything right now, they're in a space of desperation. Mm. And they're not, but what they're failing to realize is that this is a creative business. It's a business, but you're in the business that deals with intellectual property, that deals with nuance, hue, tone, so many different variables that aren't concrete.
Can't reduce it to data.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
But yet and still, they're trying to reduce it to data. And as long as they continue to do that, they're going to unfortunately find themselves to be kind of like always trying to catch up and then being in the last and then turning into something else. Like, they have to realize that you have to kind of be in partnership with artists. The music should be, the people who do the music should be able to make the money, not just Chevrolet or McDonald's or whatever it is that uses these licenses. But the deals are so like unbalanced that it's just natural, and just we've seen cases of this for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And it's funny because they're so in the middle of it that they don't even see it. Like this conversation, if they hear it, they probably would be like, oh, but not even hear the place that I'm coming from. The place I'm coming from, again, is not to berate, but it's hopefully to appeal to the human spirit still. of the person who's in business and to truly understand what they're in business for and what they're doing so that, you know, the people who do the music can also benefit because it's enough for everybody.
Yeah.
It's enough for everybody.
You know Jay-Z. You know Jay-Z.
I know Jay-Z.
Like, personally. I know he's, I know. You know, listen to your stuff pre-release and you guys, you know, both New Yorkers came up that way. Mm-hmm. So he's got Tidal. Mm-hmm. Questlove, who's also a friend of yours. I know he's got a thing going on Pandora. You're on Apple Music. Do the platforms matter? Are there differences? How do you look at what makes a particular company or platform? You know, there's Amazon in the mix. There's Spotify. How are they going to show whether they're more righteous than another?
Or what's the differentiator between those companies?
Yeah, I mean, for a consumer who cares about music and musicians and how healthy the business is going forward, how are we going to be able to tell whether one is better than the other for the artist, to support?
Well, I mean, I think the way you tell is through content. And I guess, you know, innovation in marketing, innovation in, you know, how they message, and specificities in their marketing and how they message. But it's ultimately content.
Like, what are you telling Eddie Q and Jimmy Iovine about? Here's where you need to get to. You know, Apple talks that they all talk about being good for artists, but where you really need to get to in order to reach some of those issues you were just talking about, you know, being...
For them, really, it's about market share. It's about consumption. It's about having the most to be the biggest because, you know, when you're a conglomerate in that way, you know, you kind of become like, I don't know if you're into comics, but I am. But you become Galactus.
Yeah.
And Galactus was the one who would swallow worlds.
Eating worlds.
That's all he did was swallow worlds.
Can somebody be Silver Surfer?
And see, Silver Surfer, that's where I believe Jay-Z is Silver Surfer, and Questlove is Silver Surfer, and I could be Silver Surfer. Mm. You know, you have to, instead of, airing complaints and stuff like that, you have to kind of see it from both sides. You have to put yourself in their shoes, right? So I understand that in order for Galactus to survive, his practical need is to eat worlds. In order for Norman Rad or Silver Surfer to save his world, he says, look, I love my dear world of peace so much, I have these, I'll go out and get other ones, but leave this one alone. Mm.
What are you excited about creatively right now? Whether it's a young producer who might have given you, you know, a file, I don't know how they give you their stuff these days, or something that you've seen, or something that you heard, something you're working on with Kennedy Center, I don't know, anything. Tell us what to look forward to.
Well, I'm excited about Kennedy Center. You know, we're getting ready to start putting together the rest of our council with the good folks there. Shouts out to Simone and Kim. But I'm really excited about that. And I am excited about this artist that I'm about to work with, this young lady from Houston. Her name is Megan Thee Stallion.
What does she do?
We'll see.
All right.
But I'm excited about that. I'm excited about, you know, seeing how this country grows. I think that it's pregnant with possibilities. There's a lot of dissension. There's a lot of bad vibe, I feel like, that's going on in the world. Always has been, but, you know, I'm excited about the spirit of the good man, you know? And I think that good spirit should be usurped and bought out of all of us. And the only way we do that is that we recognize and accept and our responsibility for the other sides of us. So I'm excited to see that discourse happen. It's happening right now live. It's being televised. The revolution, as Gil Scott said.
Yeah.
You know, that's about it. I'm excited to be making some more music and to putting some stuff out here.
Well, that's a big part of the role of the artist, I know, is to not only hold up a mirror, but show us what we can be. So, I appreciate you sitting down and having this conversation with me.
Thank you.
More than you know.
All right, well, Tip, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for Fort Knox.
I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. Subscribe wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Check out the reviews on iTunes, maybe leave me one of your own. Also, subscribe to the Fort Knox channel on YouTube, FORTTKNOX.com/YouTube. Matter of fact, you can see the full video of this conversation with Q-Tip there on YouTube right now. Also, follow me, John Fort, on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. You'll see video from more of these interviews, and you can say hi to me live, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. There I tackle some of the most interesting business and economic issues with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Just go to YouTube and search for Fort Knox, or go to LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter, search for John Fort, and follow me. Meanwhile, share this, tell a friend, drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or FortKnox.com, and as always, thank you for lending an ear.